Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to take a stack of information, really dig in, and pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight for you.
That's the plan.
So today, we're doing a fascinating dive into a June 2025 update. It's from an investor, goes by the name Tokyo, who shares insights into their portfolio companies.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission, really, for this deep dive is to understand the core philosophy, you know, what's guiding these decisions, and hopefully get a clear picture of some, well, some pretty intriguing businesses along the way.
Exactly. And the source material we're looking at, it's a personal analysis, but it's structured almost like a journalistic piece.
Right.
It's really important for you, the listener, to know upfront, this is not investment advice or tax advice for that matter.
Absolutely not.
Tokyo is just sharing their interpretation, their analysis of company news, really for their own investment behavior. Our role here is simply to impartially convey the ideas and the data that are in that original source material. We're not endorsing the viewpoints. We're not offering any financial recommendations. It's all about understanding the perspective and, you know, the underlying details that shape it.
Okay, great. Yeah. So let's unpack this core philosophy then, because, I mean, in a world that feels full of market noise, what really guides this investor's decisions? It seems quite focused.
Yeah, it really is. And what's fascinating, I think, is the very clear distinction Tokyo draws. It's between what they call the loud, fast-paced media world, you know, dominated by politics, central bankers, short-term headlines.
All that noise.
Exactly, all that noise. Versus the real world of actual companies. The emphasis is hugely on focusing on the fundamental data.
Okay.
Like, how robust is a business model, really?
Yeah.
How does a firm handle challenges? What's its long-term value creation potential? It's about keeping a remarkably cool head and, well, staying the course.
Staying the course, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not getting swayed by the day-to-day churn.
Precisely.
So if that's the philosophy, how does that translate into the portfolio structure? You mentioned these categories, icon, motor, and favorite, and what are they about?
Right. It's quite structured. The portfolio is basically divided into three areas.
Okay.
First, you've got the Eichen, which translates to oaks. These are 12 positions. Think mostly blue chips, good dividends, plus some solid small caps.
The stable ones.
Exactly. The anchors. The goal here is around 6-7% return per year, and they're primarily buy and hold long-term stuff.
Got it.
Then there's the motor category. This is 10 positions. These are stocks picked for strong, stable earnings growth, aiming a bit higher here, maybe 10% per year or more.
Okay.
Also pretty much buy and hold.
Right.
And finally, the favoritin, or favorites. These are 6 newer stock purchases, companies that have, you know, compelling business models, interesting products, or maybe they just seem undervalued right now.
A bit more dynamic, perhaps.
A little bit. Mostly buy and hold still, but maybe some potential for shorter holding periods for individual stocks if they hit their targets or the situation changes.
Makes sense.
And just as a point of context, the current cash position in the portfolio is sitting at 25%.
25% cash. Okay, that gives us a good picture of the structure.
Yeah.
Now let's see that philosophy in action. What were the recent moves in June 2025? Specifically, what was sold?
Well, the main sale was Netflix.
Netflix, okay.
Yeah, I mean, its share price has done incredibly well since the start of the year, a really impressive recovery after that big drop back in 2021.
It really bounced back.
It did. But the expected annual return for new money invested now, Tokyo calculated it at just 2%.
Only 2%.
Yeah. So Tokyo viewed that as basically overbought. But it's not just the low return expectation. It's also about discipline,
yeah.
Right? Rebalancing even from winners if they no longer fit.
Right.
And the sort of up and down nature of the stock, it just didn't really fit the stable profile they want for that Eichen category.
Doesn't sound like an oak.
Not anymore, perhaps. And this move also fits with maybe a broader goal they mentioned of slightly reducing overall USA exposure in the portfolio.
Okay, that makes sense. A disciplined exit. So what about the new additions? Let's start with Johnson & Johnson. What's the thinking there?
Right. Johnson & Johnson was a buy. Now, the company's admittedly been through a bit of a weak patch. You know, the baby powder scandal and then spinning off the consumer health division, Kenvue.
Yeah, that was big news.
It was. But the flip side is this spinoff allows J&J to really concentrate on its other divisions, particularly pharma and medical devices.
So have higher margins, right?
Significantly higher margins. So the investor sees this as an opportunity, a leaner, more focused, higher margin business emerging. The expected annual return for money invested now is pegged at 15%.
15%. Okay. Interesting play on the restructuring.
Mm-hmm.
And the other purchase was Airbus. How does that fit in, especially with reducing U.S. exposure?
Yeah, Airbus was the other buy. Tokyo mentioned a long-standing desire, actually, to be involved in the large commercial aircraft market, which is, let's face it, pretty much a duopoly between Airbus and Boeing. So Airbus was chosen specifically, as you said, to help diversify away from the U.S. market exposure. Now, there's definitely awareness of China trying to get into this space with COMAC.
Right, the C919.
Exactly. But the source makes a crucial point. Aircraft certifications, building trust, track records. That takes years, decades even.
It's a high barrier to entry.
Huge barrier. So China isn't likely to be a significant threat until maybe 2028 or so. And even then, it doesn't necessarily spell the end for players like Airbus. It's a long-term bet on a critical industry.
And the expected return there?
For Airbus, the expected annual return is 13%.
13%. Okay. Any other sort of interesting takeaways from the broader portfolio that jumped out?
Yeah, one quick one. British American Tobacco, BAT. It was seen as undervalued, and it sort of proved the old saying, right? Those declared dead live longer. With a personal dividend yield over 7% and the stock price going up, that investment's now up about 16.8% for Tokyo. It just highlights that even in that stable Eichen category, there are actually five companies right now offering an expected return of 10% or more.
So stability doesn't mean zero growth potential?
Exactly. Stability doesn't have to mean stagnation.
Okay, great examples.
Mm-hmm.
Let's zoom in now on one of those foundational holdings you mentioned, Air Liquid. What's really compelling about this company? How does it fit that real-world focus?
Right. Air Liquid. Well, they're probably best known for their huge air separation units, ASUs. These are massive industrial plants.
Right.
They basically take ordinary air and separate it into its core components, oxygen, nitrogen, and argon. You find these enormous facilities, you know, all over the globe. Baytown in the U.S., Secunda in South Africa are just examples.
And the process is quite complex.
Oh, yeah. It involves purifying the air meticulously, then complex heat exchange processes, and finally distillation to separate the gases with very high purity. It's fundamental to so many industries.
Okay, so those are the giants. Is there a smaller scale version? And critically, how does Air Liquid connect to the whole hydrogen economy discussion?
Good question. Yes, they also have smaller, less capital-intensive plants called PSAs, pressure swing absorption units.
PSAs, okay.
These are more compact, modular. They can be installed quickly for, say, smaller companies or hospitals. They produce oxygen or nitrogen at maybe 90-95% purity, good enough for many applications, just not the ultra-high 99.99% from the big ASUs.
Gotcha. And hydrogen.
Right, hydrogen. Air Liquid is involved across the board. They produce gray hydrogen, which comes from natural gas using steam methane reformers, SMRs. It's a chemical process, basically.
Yep. Standard way for now.
Pretty much. Now, if you capture the C-Era that comes off that SMR process and store it, that becomes blue hydrogen.
Okay, lower carbon.
Lower carbon, yeah. And then the goal for many is green hydrogen. That's made using renewable electricity, wind or solar, to power electrolyzers. Things like PEM or AEL electrolyzers, which split water into hydrogen and oxygen with basically zero emissions. Air Liquid is investing heavily there.
Very comprehensive.
Yeah.
I also heard they're involved in like really specialized gases. What are those used for?
Absolutely. They produce critical specialty gases, things like silane, ammonia, phosphine, arsine, carbon tetrafluoride, fluorine, chlorine, the list goes on.
Sounds very specific.
Extremely. These are vital for making semiconductors. We're talking about processes like CVD chemical vapor deposition for putting down silicon layers, making nitrides for insulation, doping chips to control conductivity, delicate etching processes.
Wow.
Yeah, even companies that have their own big ASU on site might still need regular deliveries of these super specialized high purity gases from Air Liquid trucks. They're indispensable for chip making.
Okay, and this is where it gets really interesting. Linking back to strategy, they're big investments, especially in that climate change megatrend.
Yeah.
This seems more than just supplying gas.
You've hit the nail on the head. Air Liquid's CapEx, their capital spending on new projects, it's climbing every year, hit a record $4.4 billion in 2024.
Wow, $4.4 billion.
Huge number. And a lot of that is specifically directed towards climate protection initiatives. Key projects include, well, there's a massive blue hydrogen project with ExxonMobil in Baytown, Texas. That's $850 million. Air Liquid supplies the ASUs for low carbon hydrogen and oxygen production, capturing CO2.
Okay.
Then on the green hydrogen front, they've got large scale electrolyzer projects. Normantin in France, 200 megawatts using solar. Eligator and Zeeland Green H2 in the Netherlands using offshore wind power, also 250 megawatts each. These are serious scale projects.
Building the infrastructure.
Exactly. And carbon capture and storage, CCS too. Projects like D'Artagnan in France, 160 million, and Aalborg in Denmark, 220 million. They use Air Liquid's own CryoCap Coast Euro capture tech. It's a cryogenic process, very efficient for storing Coast Euro underground, or maybe reusing it in e-fuels or cement.
So they're not just supplying hydrogen or capturing carbon, they're providing the core technology and building the plants.
Precisely. And beyond that, they're still investing heavily in electronics gases for memory chips, oxygen for EV battery production, even decarbonizing copper recycling. It really shows this shift, you know, from just industrial gas supplier to being a foundational enabler of the green transition. They're embedding themselves right across these future value chains.
That's a really powerful strategic positioning. So what does all this mean for their financial health?
Mm-hmm.
And why is it foundational for Tokyo, even if they're not buying more right now?
Well, sure. The hydrogen hype has definitely helped push their market cap over $100 billion, makes them one of Europe's top 25 companies.
Big company.
Huge. But importantly, underneath the hype, their actual net margin has improved. It was around 10-11% for much of the 2010s. Now it's closer to 12%. And Tokyo sees potential for maybe 15% down the line. That points to strong management, not just hype.
Good fundamentals.
Right. So the investor sees Air Liquid as a cornerstone, a foundational part of the portfolio, expected to deliver a steady 7% annual return. Solid, even if not spectacular right now. So while it's strong, they're not adding more at the current fairly high price.
Makes sense. Hold what you've got.
Yeah, the company shows that solid upward trend in earnings, free cash flow, debt's manageable and improving, return on equity is good, it's financially robust.
Okay, great deep dive on Air Liquid. Let's switch gears now to ANA, the airport operator. What's their core story, especially thinking about post-pandemic recovery?
Right, ANA. For them, obviously, the key metric is passenger numbers. And while they, like everyone, took a massive hit during COVID.
Understandably.
The recovery has been, frankly, impressive. They set new records in 2023, 294.4 million passengers, and then smashed that again in 2024, hitting 369.4 million.
Wow, that's a strong bounce back.
It really shows the resilience of travel demand, doesn't it?
Definitely. So how are they planning to keep that momentum going and grow revenue beyond just the recovery phase?
Well, a key part of their strategy is expanding outside of Spain. They're actively acquiring and managing airports internationally.
Oh, interesting. Like where?
Good examples are London Luton Airport in the UK, which they own. And they've made significant moves in Brazil with major concessions. There was the Northeast Brazil concession and then the Congonhas concession that added 11 more airports, including the really important São Paulo Congonhas hub.
So diversifying geographically.
Exactly. And beyond just getting more passengers through the doors, they're also focused on increasing the revenue per passenger. That comes from two streams. Basically, aeronautical revenue, that's things like landing fees regulated by the Spanish state through a framework called DORA, and then commercial revenue, that's all the shops, the restaurants, duty free, parking, you name it.
Right, trying to get more spend from each traveler.
Precisely.
Okay, but with all this growth, expanding into Brazil, hitting record passenger numbers, that must require significant investment in infrastructure, right? What does it look like?
Absolutely. And that's a key point right now. To support the growth and keep everything modern, ANA has major CapEx plans. They just got the green light for a huge expansion at Barcelona's main airport, El Prat.
Ah, okay. Big project.
Very big. CapEx is expected to shoot up quite sharply until about 2029, then sort of normalize by 2031. The main part is a new satellite terminal. T1B.
But big CapEx usually means pressure on cash flow.
Exactly. And analysts have already factored this in, reducing ANA's expected free cash flow. That's why the expected annual return currently looks quite low, only about 3%.
Only 3%.
Yeah. It's also worth noting, just as a detail, they did a 1-for-10 stock split back in June 2025. But yeah, if you looked at their free cash flow chart, you'd see that deep COVID dip.
Right.
Then costs for adjusting capacity post-COVID, then the costs linked to that big Brazil airports deal, the BOAB deal.
A lot of cash going out.
Yeah. And looking ahead, from 2027, the next phase of that state regulation, DORA III, is expected to bring more CapEx requirements, which will likely keep pressure on free cash flow for a while.
So a period of heavy investment ahead.
Definitely. But despite those pressures, the underlying financials, things like equity, debt levels, return on equity, they generally show improvement, indicating the core business remains strong. It's just navigating a heavy investment cycle.
Okay, understood. Well, you've certainly taken us on quite a journey today. from, you know, a really disciplined investor's philosophy through to the nuts and bolts of a global gas giant like Air Liquide and the growth strategy of an airport operator like Anity.
Yeah, indeed. And I think if we try and connect it all to the bigger picture, what it really highlights is how crucial it is to look beyond the sort of the immediate headlines, the noise,
right,
and really understand the fundamental business strategies, the long-term investment cycles these companies are navigating. You know, looking at Air Liquide's green investments or ANA's big expansion plans, even though their short-term return forecasts look quite different, it shows how businesses are tackling growth and challenges based on where they sit in the real economy.
Yeah, it's about seeing those underlying currents.
Exactly, seeing those threads that connect the kind of micro details to the much bigger macro trends.
So that brings us to a final question, really, for you, the listener, to maybe mull over. When you're looking at a company, maybe just out of personal interest or even for professional understanding, how much attention do you pay to those real-world fundamentals, the strategy, the investments, the operations, versus the, let's call it, market noise that so often dominates the headlines? Where do you find your focus falls? Something to think about.